Yesterday, our topic had to do with the Galilean ministry of our Lord, and we worked through the longest account of that in the four Gospels, namely the very lengthy section of Matthew's Gospel, which details voluminously the events of Jesus' Galilean ministry, or at least more so than the others. Today, since we ran out of time yesterday, we will look at the much shorter account as found in the Gospel according to Luke, in which he gives us some of the same and some new and unique portions of the Galilean ministry. So, without any delay, would you please turn to Luke chapter 4, where we continue from where we left off previously. In case you're wondering why I'm sitting today, there are two good reasons. Number one, as I have just told you, I'm now an old man. I need to sit down. Number two, a very much better reason, that Jesus himself sat down in order to teach. And this is still the custom in many Oriental countries. For example, if you travel in the Asian subcontinent, you'll see some of those statues of Buddha. When he's sitting down, they say this is his teaching position. And when he's standing up, that's his preaching position. So today I will be teaching more than I'll be preaching. So if you don't mind, we'll just put up with that. So Luke 4 is before us, verse 14 and following. What you have there is what we've already discussed more briefly in the account in Mark's Gospel, where Jesus came back to Nazareth after he had spent considerable amount of time in his ministry. He came back to his hometown, and they had some questions regarding, you know, this homegrown boy as to how he could suddenly be such an authority. Well, here we have it in Luke's Gospel as the very first account in regards to his Galilean ministry. And why does Luke move it forward like this? I think very definitely it is for thematic purposes. And if you want to explore that idea, you might read the article that I wrote some years ago for the Society of Biblical Literature, where we show how this poetic section here dovetails with the very last speech in the book of Acts, where both relate to the rejection by the Jews and by Jesus turning to the Gentiles, because they will wish to see, whereas, you know, those who are currently blind, the Jews, do not wish to see. So there's kind of a correlation here. The acceptance of the good news by the Gentiles is commonly a theme throughout Luke and Acts, and the rejection by the same token by many of the people who were of Jesus' own race, namely Jewish, that drove them literally to the Gentile world. And this is also repeated in the book of Acts in the apostolic experience. So you see there the quotation in verse 18 and following from Isaiah 61, where the messianic actions are related to the ministry of Jesus, by which then he can say, as he does after he closes the book, that today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. And of course, those present wondered, how can the son of Joseph, and we know that family, right? How can he say such gracious words? And Jesus, proceeding from that, suggests that, well, just maybe you are doubting me. You are probably suggesting, well, physician, heal yourself. Do some magical tricks here, if you will, in Nazareth, like happened around Capernaum. But Jesus rejects that attitude by suggesting, these are very volatile statements here, as he gives the examples of what happened in the time of Elijah and Elisha in the Old Testament. Elijah favored specially a widow woman from Zarephath of Sidon. Now, that's rather volatile to a Jewish audience, because the people in Lebanon, as it's known today, Phoenicia, as it's known then, were very much enemies of the Jews in earlier times. And the second example, well, why should he then favor somebody from that terrible people? Second example, in the age of Elisha, Naaman the prophet, the leper, was cured, And, well, what about the Israelites? Were there any lepers cured magically and specially like that? Well, it was a Syrian. Well, even today, between the Israelite country, Palestine, Israel, as we call it more commonly today, there is no love lost between the people of Israel and the people of Syria. They've been at loggerheads since time immemorial. And yet God showed special favor to them. He had said too much for those in that synagogue. And so they proceeded to take him out to the hillock on which the city was built. And believe me, there is a huge hill leading up to Nazareth. I will never, ever forget, as we were coming out of Nazareth on the bus and we were going down this winding road, the guide assured us that we should not worry as we were getting further and further down. If you are scared, just close your eyes like the bus driver does. And, you know, that really cheered us up. Anyway, they were going to throw him down from the hill on which their city was built. And while Luke doesn't make a big to-do about it, is this another miracle? You know, he just walked right on through, and gone he was. They couldn't lay a finger on him. He doesn't explain, you know, how this happened, but he's gone. So this is how Luke builds up this narrative, by giving a little bit more background as to what really happened here with these specific examples, and how Jesus already, throughout his ministry, was showing that his interest was not only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, as was the common idiom of the day, that's thus it should be. No, his ministry was much wider. It was to all mankind. The chapter concludes with a brace of healings. You know, in each instance, there is a rebuke of that which is a hindrance. For example, the demons who bother Jesus by teasing him, and the fever which bothered Simon's mother-in-law, and likewise when the sun is going down, obviously the Sabbath is over now, they can bring their people because they can carry them, right? Later in the day, as the sun is going down, and they bring all kinds of people who likewise have a demonic problem, and he rebukes those demons also. So in each of those three accounts, there is a rebuke by Jesus of the evil, whether that be demons or disease, and there is a cure. And so, obviously, this made quite an impression. As people come from all over the place, as we see in the last paragraph of chapter 4, and they actually beg him to stay, but he says, I've got to go other places too. I can't just limit myself to this one location. Well, that brings us to chapter 5, where we have the calling of the disciples by the Sea of Galilee. Later in this hour today, hopefully we'll get to the Gospel of John, where in the opening chapter, we have an encounter prior to this particular event where the disciples are called to follow Jesus on a full-time basis. In John 1, we have an instance where several of the disciples were with John the Baptist, and among them was Andrew and another one who is not named, and Andrew first brings his brother. Of course, that's Peter. And so, obviously, Peter had met Jesus before this, so had Andrew, so had probably others, but here they are called to full-time followership. And these four fishermen by the Sea of Galilee are challenged to do something they normally would not do, to throw their nets out into the deep after they had, of course, spent the night fishing and had been unsuccessful. They are to try to be successful at a time normally that was not intended for fishing. And they see that when they haul in their huge haul of fishes, that this is obviously a divine man who made this possible. And Peter says in verse 8, depart from me, I am a sinful man. He sees himself unworthy to be in the presence of such a one. But yet when Jesus calls them to follow, they leave their nets and they follow him. And, you know, Luke is even stronger on this point than the other evangelists, because he doesn't say they left their nets, but they left everything and followed him. Everything. In other words, it was a total commitment. And Luke oftentimes shows this absolute renouncement of worldly things when the call comes to follow Jesus. Well, moving forward now, we probably should make a little bit of speed, not too much, but some. We move to chapter 6, and there we have another Sabbath situation. Well, probably we should back up a little bit to the end of chapter 5. We have a trilogy here, just as we had in the other Gospels, but I don't think we made a mention of it in those connections. So I will here. You will see at the end of chapter 5, there's a reference to a bridegroom, to a new garment, and to new wine in regard to old wineskins. Now, in each case, what is being talked about here is either Jesus or Jesus' new way of teaching about God as compared to the old way that the Pharisees had fostered. And, of course, this is the superior way. And it then carries over into the next chapter, where we get to a case in point about the Sabbath. When the disciples pluck the ears of grain as they walk through the fields and rub them in their fingers, this was seen to be a violation of the Sabbath law, because rubbing out grain was work, and that was forbidden on the Sabbath. Plucking the grain to eat was okay, that was allowed, but on the Sabbath, you should have plucked it the day before. You can eat on the Sabbath, but you can't pluck the grain, and you can't rub it out on your fingers either. And this is one of those cases where Jesus says the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And he's quite emphatic about it when you read the Greek text, you know, Lord of the Sabbath, the Son of Man is. That's the word order here. Lord of the Sabbath is the key point here. Jesus, God, created the Sabbath as a day of rest, and Jesus, being God, can define how the Sabbath is to be used. And mercy is greater than sacrifice, we saw in another connection. And then in the next example, in verse 6 and following, about the case of the man in the synagogue who is in need of healing. His right hand is withered. We have that same question that we saw in the Gospel of Mark. Is it acceptable to do nothing, to do good, or to do evil on the Sabbath? Of course, you can't do good if you let the man sit there in his present compromised condition. So once again, this matter of he being the Lord of the Sabbath comes out, which then causes them to be a dither about what they should do with Jesus. And that's the way the chapter ends. They're filled with fury. And what can we do with him? At this point, I would like for you to pull out of your file appendix, I think it's appendix D, where we have the call of the disciples. And this is in your course management policy statement. And the reason that you have it is that sometimes there is a benefit in seeing some things that some interpreters get stumbled over, and by seeing text side by side, you can see that, there's really not a problem. So let's look at Appendix D, the call of the 12. And you'll notice that in the third of the three columns, the account in Luke chapter 6, we have a special notation that after Jesus had spent the night in prayer, which is typical of Luke, you know, showing Jesus regularly in prayer. The others do this too, but not with the same regularity. In that context, he chose 12 to be apostles out of the greater number of disciples. This might be a good time to stop for a moment and to define the difference between being a disciple and being an apostle. Would any of you wish to venture the difference between being a disciple and an apostle? Yeah?
I think I've heard that apostles had to have actually seen Jesus.
They had to do what?
Actually have seen Jesus.
Oh, yes, very definitely.
Where a disciple could have maybe just heard.
Okay, and they also had a special commission, didn't they? They had seen Jesus and walked with him for a long period of time, and could also, as we find in the first chapter of the book of Acts, to be witnesses to the resurrection and to have been with him from the beginnings of ministry. So he chose 12 to be specially with him from the larger number of disciples, those who had heard him. The word discipulus, the Latin discipulus, well, whatever the Greek is, didaskalos, I don't know. Anyway, that's teach Greek. The word for disciple has to do with learning. And apostolos has to do with being sent on with a commission. and they were to be witness to the resurrection. So he chose 12 out of the larger number of followers, and there were many other followers. These were to be special witnesses for him. Well, so that's how Luke introduces him. We will see the authority given to them also in Matthew and in Mark. But you notice the listing. In each instance of the three columns, you find one name always at the head of the list, and this is Simon Peter. Simon Peter. Both names are given. He originally was called Simon, but Jesus said he will be called Cephas, which means Peter, the rock. And he would be a rock for the rest to lean upon and to stand upon because of his leadership. And so he would appear in most of the significant stories where Jesus chooses out a small group of disciples, and also in the book of Acts, in the early chapters of the book of Acts, Peter seems to be in the lead in regard to the events of the first 11 chapters of the book of Acts. So he's always listed first. When we get near the end, wait a minute, there's something else here that probably we should lift out. In the middle column, Mark, James and John, the brothers, are surnamed Boanerges, Boanerges, sons of thunder. Now, why that? Well, perhaps because they sometimes showed their temper. They were a little bit more volatile than some of the others. When we get to chapter 9 of Luke, we will see that as Jesus makes his journey toward Jerusalem, and they come to this Samaritan village, and this village refuses to give them housing overnight, it is these two brothers, James and John, who come to Jesus and say, nuke the place. Well, not exactly like that, but they said, send fire from heaven, destroy it, okay? And so, yeah, Jesus says, hold on, boys, you know, I've got a future for these Samaritans. And of course, we will see later that the Samaritan people also could have people of faith, as we will see certainly also in the book of Acts. So Boanerges, James and John, they perhaps were a little bit more expressive than some of the others, and they were called sons of thunder. Matthew, if you'll look at the first column in verse 3, is referred to as the tax collector. Now, you knew that, but for it to be specially mentioned again in this listing, and none of the others do, it's a way of Matthew emphasizing that he was not acceptable to the Jews because he worked for the Romans. He was a tax collector, and he was one of the 12 who obviously, probably, might in normal situations have had a problem with, look at Luke's column, Simon, who was called the Zealot. Now, who were the Zealots? Those were the Jewish people who had a severe grudge against the Romans. And on the other end of the spectrum, we have Matthew, who could work for the Romans as a tax collector. And how could those two coexist in the group of Jesus' disciples? They weren't all of the same political party by any means. But I think that says something even for the modern day church, that sometimes we let little differences get in the way of our working together, and there is no place where there is a problem, as far as we know in the Gospels, between Matthew and Simon the Zealot, because they were both dedicated to following Jesus and being his apostles, his emissaries. All right, so those are some of the interesting things. However, some folks find problematic at the end of the listing that Thaddeus is listed by both Matthew and Mark, and we don't find Thaddeus in Luke's column, but the usual understanding is, verse 16 of the Luke column, that this is the same person as is named Judas here, the son of James. Actually, there are two Judases in Luke's column, the other one called Iscariot, whom we know a little bit better as the traitor. So Thaddeus is probably Judas, the son of James, and Simon the Cananean, who is referred to in Matthew and Mark, is probably the same as Simon, who is also called the Zealot. All right, so he's a Cananean, he's also a Zealot. So the one thing they all agree upon is that the betrayer should be specially listed at the very end because he's the bad guy in the bunch, and they uniformly refer to him as the betrayer or the traitor. All right, so perhaps by looking at the unified account in these several evangelists, this might be of some benefit to have done. Any questions on that little exercise? Comments? Shall we go on? We'll go back to Luke's gospel, and we found ourselves somewhere in chapter 6 when we left it. And as we go on to chapter 6, verse 11, make that verse 17, verse 17, we come to what is called the Sermon on the Plain. Now you will notice, if you haven't already, that this is a cluster of sayings, and it has many of the same sayings that we had in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's Gospel. Why is it called the Sermon on the Plain? Because, well, Luke introduces this way, that Jesus came down with them and stood on a level place. Probably the same mountain that Matthew is speaking about, but at a particular niche in the mountain where he felt wanted to address, and that's now a particular problem. Now, we said yesterday or the day before that Matthew 5 was very special because it had the Beatitudes and great numbers. Well, Luke here also has some Beatitudes, but many less. And thus we have them in verse 20, and they're counterbalanced by four woes that immediately follow, which give the opposite. In the Matthew Beatitudes, we have more of a spiritual emphasis, whereas here this is a little bit more of a physical emphasis than the ones we have in Matthew's Gospel in greater numbers. All right, so as we proceed through chapter 6, this is mostly sayings that we've looked at before from Matthew's Sermon on the Mount, so we need not to revisit that. Let's go to chapter 7. This is a very interesting chapter, and it's primarily of materials unique to Luke. Because, for one thing, well, not everything is unique to Luke, but we'll get to that starting with verse 11. Let's first of all back up a little bit to the beginning of chapter 7, where Jesus comes to Capernaum, and there is a centurion, a Roman military officer, over 100 soldiers. Usually the centurions in the gospel are very highly regarded people, people of high moral stature, and he is described here as being worthy. By whom? By the Jewish elders, to be given consideration by Jesus. Now this is very unusual that Jews should plead for a Gentile soldier. So he must have been some amazing person. And amazingly enough, when he makes his case with Jesus, he says to him, as we have in verse 6, "I am not worthy to have you come." See, he's a humble man. The Jews said, "He is worthy for you," and he admits, "No, I am not worthy." Nevertheless, he is a man of great faith, and his request for his servant to be cured is granted. And the concluding verse, and we've seen this before in Matthew and Mark, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." This centurion is so highly honored. Now we come to the women section of chapter 7 and going into chapter 8 as well. Here we have lifted out a widow from Nain. And in your NIV Bible, you have a number of really fine maps. We'll look at the maps later, but Nain is on the southern edge of Galilee, fronting practically on the Valley of Jezreel, also called the Valley of Esdraelon, which is the breadbasket of Israel. But otherwise, Nain is pretty much of an unknown city in biblical times. Here, this is a place where they see a funeral procession coming out of town. And apparently, as was typical, and still happens in some Near Eastern villages, when a person dies, within a few hours, they carry this person away on a stretcher and bury the person right away. You know, it's not like you wait a few days till you gather people from all around the globe, but they all live nearby. And this is what happened. And this woman, it was her only son. And Jesus comes and he touches, well, the stretcher or whatever he's carried on. My RSE translation says he touched the bier. Now, please, you Milwaukee guys, don't understand that wrongly. He touched the bier. But it is an expression of Jesus caring that normally you do not touch anything associated with a dead man because you would be unclean. But Jesus was above this kind of thing. He had compassion on this woman whose only son had died. You can imagine how another woman in the gospel would have felt sometime later. I'm talking about the Virgin Mary now, when she saw her son on the cross, how it pierced her heart, as we saw in the nativity accounts of Luke. Anyway, Jesus had compassion, and he heals this man, brings him back to life. And the conclusion in verse 16 is, a great prophet has arisen. Now, I make a mention of the fact that he was a great prophet, because later in the chapter, that is being denied by a Pharisee, that Jesus could possibly be a prophet. But here these people from Nain, they acknowledge, a great prophet has arisen and visited his people. Okay. We have another account interspersed here about John the Baptist, and I think we have touched on that previously, so we'll skip by it at this point, to verse 36, where we have a second account in this chapter dealing with a woman who was specially favored by Jesus because of her great faith. And the situation has to do with a Pharisee giving a dinner and inviting Jesus to be present. And yes, Jesus did, on occasion, mingle with the Pharisees. We have a number of occasions where he was invited to dinner. And why was he invited to dinner? Well, probably, usually to check him out, or maybe to find some fault with him. And here is a perfect situation. While Jesus is there at dinner, a woman from the city, obviously, she is not the kind you, like I said yesterday, you take home the mother. She was described here simply as a sinner. Well, who isn't a sinner, right? But anyway, she was a woman of bad reputation, and she comes and she weeps over the feet of Jesus, allowing her tears to wet his feet, and with her hair she dries, and then she kisses those feet. And this is a contrast to the kind of treatment the Pharisee had given, that he should have given to Jesus, but didn't when he entered. Normally, in the Near Eastern custom, when you invite people, it would be the expected thing that guests would be greeted specially. And we don't do this in our society, but this is still a custom in some Middle Eastern countries, that the men will embrace each other or kiss each other warmly on the cheek, you know, not with their hands, but actually with their mouth, not a mouth to mouth, but mouth to cheek. And he didn't do that. He didn't show the usual customs of courtesy, nor did he dry the dust off the dusty feet from, you know, the hot roadbeds that are typical. He didn't show hospitality. The woman, in her own way, had done it. And so, well, the Pharisee is a little bit nonplussed by this woman touching Jesus. And in his mind, he is saying, verse 39 says, if this man were a prophet, he would have known what kind of woman this is who is touching him. She is a sinner. If he were a prophet, that's the key. But see, what the Pharisee does not know is that Jesus is a prophet, as you'd seen earlier, and I will explain soon why I say that. Timaeus?
How did she get into the Pharisee's house?
How did she get there?
Yeah.
Well, I presume that she may have been looking for an opportunity to see Jesus, and she just walked in the door. Right. Uninvited. Uninvited. Nobody stopped her. I mean, why should they? Pharisees are pretty smug people. Nobody bothers them because they're kind of separatistic. So it could be done rather easily.
Don't they not eat with unclean people, though?
Well, the Pharisees certainly wouldn't have wanted her there, that's for sure. And so he was a little bit probably upset, but even more so since he is probably wanting to find fault with Jesus. You know, why would Jesus not just immediately expel her? After all, he's Jewish too. Well, Jesus is a different kind of a Jew compared to what the Pharisee was. And so she has the free rein to come in from behind, where he was probably reclining at dinner, and his feet are sticking out in the back, as you usually do as you recline on, you know, one hand and eat with the other hand at these low-slung tables. And so it was easy for her to get at his feet because they're sticking out in the back. Please.
Why would Jesus have addressed Simon, and I'm assuming that's Simon Peter rather than...
This is Simon the Pharisee.
Simon the Pharisee.
Okay. Yeah. There are a lot of Simons. And you might call this one Simple Simon because he didn't understand very much about what makes for a prophet, because, you know, even the people of Nain had recognized Jesus as a prophet, and what the Pharisee saw was only the obvious. He could see what the woman had been, but because Jesus was a true prophet, he could see who the woman now is and what she might become. Okay? And of course, therein lies a lesson too, isn't there? That sometimes people get judgmental of others because of a certain thing that happened in the past, and they judge that this person is obviously evil through and through. And this is certainly the opinion that the Pharisee must have had of this woman. And how could Jesus not recognize that? Well, he saw more. He saw who the woman now is and might become. And that's really sort of a paradigm of what salvation is about. We're all sinners, but God sees more in us. He sees forgiven sinners if we attach ourselves to the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for our sins and made us whole again, and who sees the potential of us living to be his true followers if we accept the forgiveness he has to offer us. So there's something in this lesson for us simply beyond the facts of the story. There is a lesson to be learned as well. Okay. Your sins are forgiven. This is the bottom line. She loved much. She loved more than Simon did, obviously. And so she is allowed to go in peace. And we may assume that she became a follower of Jesus because of the experience she had had. And that's probably why she came in the first place, because she wanted to be a follower of Jesus. Chapter 8. This is the third of the women's stories in this compacted section. And we will see that as Jesus moves about through the villages bringing good news, that it was possible for him to do that because he had support. He had support. Sometimes you may wonder how a man who could say that the Son of Man has no place to lay his head, even though the foxes have holes, all right, the birds of the air have nests, how could a person who had nothing in terms of material goods to speak of, how could he be an itinerant preacher? Well, here I think you have the answer. He had some very helpful supporters. And there are some who have suggested that this may be the beginnings of the Lutheran Women's Missionary League. If you take a look at the names of the women, you don't have to remember them necessarily, but they're really easy to remember. Just think of Mary Jo and Sue. You know, Mary, the one from Magdala, Mary Magdalene, as we usually know her, and Joanna, the wife of Cusa, who is Herod's steward. See, connections with Herod the king. Yeah, even some of the royalties' connections followed Jesus, and she is an example of that, this Joanna woman, and then Susanna, about whom we know nothing at all. And others, many other women too followed him, and they gave of their means. They supported him. You know, you have this Lutheran Women's Missionary League mite box tradition you've probably heard about, with supporting missionary projects and do many marvelous things. So Jesus had a group like that too that was supportive. Okay, moving on. We come to Chapter 9. If I move too fast, just stop me on the way and pick out something that you wanted to talk about, but I am always aware of the fact we can't cover everything. Chapter 9 is the account of Jesus sending out the 12, the ones that he had previously identified as apostles, and he gave them power and authority to preach and to heal. Yes, they were able to preach and to heal. At this point, eventually they would also be able to teach after Jesus had taught them more. But now already they could proclaim the good news of Jesus. And he gives them authority and tells them that if they get rejected, which could happen in some places, that they are simply to knock the dust off their feet and go on. What's the significance of knocking the dust off their feet? All right, the judgment is on you guys. I don't want to even take your dirt out of your territory because you have rejected the good news of my master, Jesus. And you know, this also carries over into the book of Acts. When we come to Acts 13, where Paul had been preaching in the synagogue at Antioch of Pisidia on his first missionary journey, he was there for a few Sabbaths, and he gathered a lot of people together. But then there was an opposition from the card-carrying synagogue members who didn't like the fact that all these Gentiles jumped in, and they persecuted Paul, and he had to leave. And they knocked the dust off their feet and went to the next city. All right, just like here, the 12 were instructed to do. So, the sending of the 12, which is also recounted in the other gospel that we've seen before. But Luke does something extra. And if we want to fast forward to chapter 10, you'll see that there is a second sending that happens in Luke's gospel, not mentioned in Matthew or Mark, and that is the sending of the 70. Sending of the 70, Luke 10, verse 1 and 2 and following, two by two, with the instruction, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers. And so they are sent out again to preach the kingdom of God, seeing it's come near to them. And in that context, now if you'll focus in on 10, verse 13, you will see that Jesus makes a denunciation of some of the cities to the north of the Sea of Galilee, Chorazin and Bethsaida and Capernaum. And why does he pronounce judgment on these cities? These are cities where he had spent major time in his preaching ministry, and they had repudiated the gospel. And because he was actually present and they didn't respond, these cities are cursed, and their judgment will be more dire than that of Tyre and Sidon in the land of the Phoenicians, which are also have woes spoken against them by the prophets of former times. These people actually had seen Jesus and had repudiated, and so even to this day, those cities are not rebuilt. Now, there are attempts from time to time to do some archaeological restorations. I know in Capernaum, for example, just south of the synagogue, they have put up a structure over the home where Peter and Andrew's, where they used to live with Peter's mother-in-law, in that site. It's kind of a worship center now, but generally speaking, those cities have not been rebuilt or re-inhabited along the Sea of Galilee, and the only one that still is a major city along the Sea of Galilee is Tiberias, where we don't know that Jesus ever visited, and of course, if he never visited there, he wouldn't have been rejected there either, but there's a good reason why he never came to Tiberias, and do you know why that is? Somebody had his headquarters there, and he was always trying to see Jesus, and he would be a thorn in the side of Jesus if he did see him, and who would that be? King Herod, yes, King Herod. He often wanted to see Jesus, and he never got the chance until Holy Week, when he's in Jerusalem for the, you know, time of the trials of Jesus. Then he gets to see him finally. And he gets to mistreat him too, as he probably had wanted to do previously. Okay, we've skipped over some things in Luke 9 that are really quite important because they're also treated in other Gospels. For example, there is defeating the 5,000, Peter's great confession, the transfiguration, and you know, unless you feel the need to go over some of those elements again, we'll just continue on.